Welcome to the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action by the Center for Humanitarian Action in Berlin. My name is Annette Ritschler and I'm the communications manager at CHAR. On day two of the CHAR conference, Dr. Pinar Okur facilitated the active session Unusual Allies and Uncomfortable Truths about which role the private sector could play in aligning humanitarian climate action. In the afternoon, CHAR director Ralf Suthoff could win her for a brief talk in the chatroom studio about her takeaways from the session and participation and the lack of trust.
In this chat room, welcome to Pinar Okur. She's a panelist also at our CHAR annual conference here. And we thank you so much for being with us and for being with us now in the podcast studio as well.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor to be present today.
Pinar, let me quickly introduce you as a person, and maybe you can then also introduce to our audience, maybe not all of them know opinion. Pinar, you are a psychologist and a criminologist, which is very impressive. You are from the Netherlands. You continued your career as a researcher and obtained a PhD on child sexual abuse among ethnic minorities in the first place. And then applying your knowledge in the field, you worked as the international program lead and researcher for the Forced Migration and Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights program at Rutgers before joining Opinion 5 years ago. Maybe tell our audience a bit about Opinion.
Sure. As a start, indeed, Opinion is quite the odd one out in this sector, as we are a social enterprise and we have built a digital engagement platform that basically spearheads the participation revolution. So our aim with our platform is to bring the voices of communities to the table and to have them participate in discussions around interventions, around programs and policies that affect their present and their future. So we want them to be as much as part of the whole sector as that we can do it without them. And we do this via this DEP, as we call it, a digital engagement platform that allows a secure and safe connection with refugees, migrants, IDPs, host communities, and they can anonymously chip in their thoughts at any point, even if they cross borders or move from camp settlements to urban areas, and we can come back to them over time. So we keep a finger at the pulse in a way, and they are able to have their voices amplified, and humanitarians and stakeholders can react on that.
Very interesting, very, very impressive work. Many thanks for sharing that. If you don't mind, we often like to ask our guests here in the chat room also, how come you started in this field? Was any moment or anything which crossed you that made you think, oh, that's where I want to engage in what you do so impressively for many years?
Thank you. Well, while I was mulling over this question, I realized that, unconsciously realizing it, I see that I've always been a defender or an amplifier of the voices of marginalized populations. And it was asked if I could have maybe a souvenir with me. I have brought with me, and apologies, of course, no one can see this, but it's a very creatively put together megaphone made from cardboard. And I brought this with me because I see this as the red line throughout my work since I started, even with my PhD, where indeed bringing the experiences and needs of child sexual abuse survivors to the table. And sexual abuse is often a case where there are no witnesses. I thought it's a responsibility that I carry with me to actually accurately listen and bring these voices out and to push for better support services in that regard. And from there, I started working for Rutgers, where the Forced Migration and Sexual Reproductive Health Program, it was also calling the attention to sexual violence in war-affected areas, where also sexual violence is often seen as a weapon in war that happens to the most vulnerable in the crisis, mostly women, but is less spoken about. So I wanted to amplify that as well and bring it into the programs that we were doing. And then, Opinion's whole aim is to amplify the voices of marginalized populations, not only of sexual violence victims of war, but any person affected by conflict. So, I think that my souvenir symbolizes that.
Yes. Thanks. It's really a shame people can't see it. Maybe we take a picture later on. It's really a self-made megaphone from paper, and it's really impressive that you did that for us. Thanks so much. Speaking about your work, mean, you shared already what you aim at with your platform, Isidora, and one of your key objectives is to make sure that the affected people, that affected populations have a role and have a say in what's going on and what aid is provided, Isidora. So it's a lot about participation. Why is that an issue at all? Why do you have to deal with that?
Well, I think there are two perspectives also in this regarding participation and the challenges that come with it. I think one is a hindrance for the communities themselves in participating, and the other is also from us, even as a social enterprise with this mission to participate with the sector. For the sake of time, also, I'm going to answer the question from the community's perspective as why it is such a big thing and why is it not always happening that they participate. And I think it boils down to one thing, which is a lack of trust. Trust is something that doesn't happen overnight. And I think there's a lack of trust from communities to participate. And I think establishing trust with affected populations is crucial, but it takes time. And unfortunately, the humanitarian sector, as we have also heard yesterday and today in the sessions, we respond rapidly and leave rapidly. And even if inputs are considered, they are often one-off, and it's not always possible to go back to the same people. But people need to believe that their input will be genuinely considered and that it will lead to meaningful changes, and they need to be aware of what is happening with their insights. So I think that lack of transparency and maybe also in that trust building, relationship building, is a reason why communities are maybe hindered from participation. And in line with that, I think also the feedback implementation gap. Even if we collect feedback, because we do want to listen and we do want to get it, there's often a gap between gathering it and making real changes. And to keep people engaged, we need to show that their feedback leads to actionable changes and results. That hinders, I think, participation. And then maybe a last one on that is that we also hear that we do try to listen, and then comes the engagement fatigue from communities, that many organizations seek feedback from the same communities, and that can overwhelm them and become skeptical about whether their input will result again in that change that they would like to see. So going back to these communities, keeping them in the loop is essential to take away that challenge of participation.
Where's this coming from? You would expect people to be happy that they can participate and do so. Is it linked to a feeling of, well, it's just a useless participation because the impact is not to be seen? I mean, especially in the humanitarian world, we have this cliche and the approach of the white men coming from the global north to the global, so-called global south, fixing the crisis and helping people with what they might need and having a good guess what they might need. And so all these feedback mechanisms, etc., are still pretty new to many agencies, and many affected people complain that even if they can provide feedback, it doesn't really change much, even if others, of course, work very well, and it's a mixed picture. Mm-hmm. Is that one of the reasons that there is a fatigue because people feel like participation doesn't make an impact?
That it becomes more like a tokenistic example. We tick the box, we've asked there for their feedback, and now we continue doing business as usual. I definitely think that is one reason of this fatigue. On the other hand, I also think, and that is not even so much to blame on the humanitarians, I would say, it has also to do with where the funding comes from and what it will cover and what not. I believe that if humanitarians truly had the option to be flexible and change course direction simply based on the input, it might be, they might do so. They would do so. At least that's what we want. That's what we're aiming for, right? However, often project money is designated for one theme or the other, and it also kind of depends on what the buzzword is that's going around. As an example, I wanted to provide this case that we did a couple of years ago where we did a project on mental health and psychosocial support, MHPSS. It's still going on. This is, of course, an important topic. And this was for cross-border care for young Syrians coming from Syria to Turkey. And the intention was very well, and it tried to co-create also with young Syrians solutions for mental health services. And so these were young Syrians who had crossed maybe a couple of years ago and already were dealing with more acute challenges or daily realities, so to say, like language barriers in the country of arrival, social tension, discrimination, and they were seeking more solutions for that rather than thinking of cross-border care on the mental health spectrum. So they were not worried anymore about that as such. I mean, of course, it's something that should still be addressed, and mental health and trauma is something that we should not take lightly. But and they provided helpful ideas, but I do feel, and they co-created even a prototype, but this topic wasn't as relevant. But from the donor perspective, MHPSS was the focus, and the humanitarians have to follow suit. Even they also saw the answers were slightly different than what they... So I think that also is something that flexibility in that donor relationships and humanitarians would does play a role as well in not responding.
Many thanks for sharing such a concrete example, and I think many humanitarians could share a lot of examples where they basically know that what they deliver in a way isn't really what people have asked for, mm-hmm. for various reasons. It might be more cost efficient, it might be just have been an offer, it might have been an in-kind donation, etc. So a very challenging setup. You have facilitated also at our conference talking about such uncomfortable truths, mm-hmm. if we are honest, talking about practices. So you have hosted also a session about unusual allies and these uncomfortable truths. What have been your takeaways from the session? We couldn't show it online, so people might be very interested if you share your takeaways.
Yes, of course. I'll try to summarize it as best as I can. I was facilitating the group that was going on to the role of the private sector in the humanitarian climate action environment. And I think we had a very positively looking group on the role of the private sector. They see a lot of advantages of collaborating with the private sector, which I'm very pleased to hear about, and especially in terms of fundraising of fast movements, but definitely also as technology as an enabler for their mission, and even in the supplier chain. So I think those were some of the positives. One. Then what is uncomfortable about it, that it does remain always an issue. Well, it comes actually back to trust, which we had with the community as well. There is a lack of trust and maybe lack of communication between the private sector and humanitarians regarding the mandates that we carry, that we have, and if that clashes with the humanitarian mission. And then also the lack of communication regarding profits, where the money goes to. So I think in terms of the resources, in terms of the future and the resources that will become available, I think one uncomfortable truth that also the humanitarian sector is facing is what weighs heavier, our ethical principles versus funding resources, and how do we balance, what do we keep as our core principle, what is an non-negotiable when we collaborate with the private sector, and what is okay if our mandates clash, or where does our responsibility stop in that? Yeah, I think that is something that stood with me, like how do we navigate the future where we do have to seek each other for better efficient support.
And what is your take? Final question from my side. What is your take? What gives you hope in this regard? I mean, especially us humanitarians like to talk about challenges, about failures, about crisis by nature. Is there anything, especially on this issue of collaboration, giving you hope that we might do better and really can move a bit, change and fix a couple of things in the foreseeable future, not only in the long term?
I think we can, and we should keep hope. We should always have hope. And I think in the end, in order to collaborate and to be effective, in the end, it's all about the people. In New Zealand, where I live, the answer to the question, and now apologies if my pronunciation in Te Reo Māori isn't too best, but is He aha te wea nui o te ao, which means what is the most important thing in the world? And the answer to this is he tangata, he tangata, he tangata, which means it is people, it is people, it is people. So I hope that in future collaborations, the views of the people, the communities are taken into account throughout the whole projects cycle before, during, and after, because we really can't do without it.
Thank you so much. What a nice ending of a podcast, and really one providing hope. Many thanks for doing that. Many thanks for bringing something to this podcast. And we definitely do a photo now with your megaphone. Many thanks for joining the conference all the way from New Zealand and our podcast studio. And it's been a great pleasure. Thank you much.
Thank you so much, Ralph, for having me.
This is it today from the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. If you have any feedback or a suggestion as to whom should be interviewed here, we'd love to hear that. Just send us an email to info@charberlin.org. Thanks for listening.